So today is Thanksgiving Day. Certainly, I think a special way to spend the Thanksgiving period, being in retreat, keeping precepts, practicing the Dhamma, spending time with people who are interested in living skillful lives, peaceful lives. That's a definitely something to say, to give thanks for, to be grateful for the opportunity. And just recognizing that on just any ordinary day, there's a tremendous amount to be to have gratitude for. And that's a really, I mean, one of the, say, in that chant of the highest blessings, that is considered one of the highest blessings, gratitude. And the word highest blessings in Pali is, say, mangala, and it's a mangala in, say, in the time of the Buddha, in, let's say, ordinary parlance, was something that brought good fortune, that brought some auspicious or beneficial element into one's life. So that just directing our attention to the quality of gratitude is that brings blessings into our life, brings good fortune. As the despite the feeling sometimes of, say, our life being a catastrophe, that's not overall. That's not the the reality, and to direct attention consciously to things that are worth being grateful for, to have gratitude toward, whether it's people, things, circumstances, oneself, those give those strength and give them kind of prominence in the mind. The very first verses of the Dhammapada are really highlight that. Like, all states of being are determined by mind. The mind leads the way, just as the tracks of the ox cart or the wheel, say the wheel tracks of the ox cart, follow the hoofprints of the ox. So too will suffering follow when, say, we act impulsively from an impure mind. Then also the all states of being are determined by mind. Mind is what leads the way, just as our shadow never leaves us, so too will happiness be with us when we act from a act or speak from a pure state of mind. This is an ancient truth and something that the Buddha, especially in putting it first and second verse of the, say, the Dhammapada, which is a collection of teachings that the Buddha is kind of summarizing in verse, kind of pith teachings, and recognizing that, you know, where we direct our mind, or where our mind, either where we direct the mind or where our mind drags us, is what is going to determine our well-being, or our dissatisfaction. So that the training of the mind is just an essential piece of living a human life skillfully. And of course, that's what we're doing here on a Thanksgiving retreat, 10 days practicing with this mind, learning how to train it, learning how to understand it, learning how to accept it, learning how to be free within the constraints of a mind. Because in the end, mind is just another phenomena in nature, and we can adapt to circumstances in nature, and we similarly adapt to the ways that the mind, you know, what it does, what its habits are. And when we understand it, it transforms it, it changes it. That they've been bringing to mind the mindfulness of breathing and the different elements of the practice that the Buddha gives for developing mindfulness of the breath. And also recognizing that there's a purpose, there's a point for developing mindfulness of breathing. It's like when the other night we chanted the discourse on mindfulness of breathing, and the Buddha sets it up immediately that the cultivation and development of mindfulness of breathing is to bring to fruition the four foundations of mindfulness. The cultivation and development of the four foundations of mindfulness is to bring into fruition the seven factors of awakening. Seven factors of awakening are for the bringing into fruition knowledge and deliverance. So that we are relying on using this simple technique, mindfulness of breathing, but then starting to tease out some of the nuances of that. And in particular, when we start to develop that mindfulness of breathing so that we're understanding how to apply these four foundations of mindfulness, where the four foundations of mindfulness takes us, immediately, is to a recognition of things as conditions in nature, body, feelings, mind. Objects of mind, states of mind. And those are, when we see it in that way or experience in that way, then we have the opportunity to relate to it from a place of not self. Because then the habit is, this is me, this is what I am. Always will be like this. This is myself. When we're in a good mood, isn't it wonderful? When we're in a bad mood, this self, who we think ourselves to be, come back to that feeling of catastrophe again. The having a tangible perspective linked to experiencing the inner world, external world, from a place of These are aspects of nature, aspects of Dhamma. And this is not a permanent self, permanent me. This aspect of change, impermanence, uncertainty, inconstancy, and unsatisfactory nature of such things, and none of it is worth picking up as a self position, as an identity. This is me, this is who I am. And that gives a tremendous amount of space and spaciousness to us, so that we can, it's not that we don't experience anything or that we dismiss experience, but it's, we've got a context to hold it in so that we don't make a problem out of it. So that in that mindfulness of breathing, and I went through the aspects of the section on the body, began on the aspect of feeling, experiencing joy or rapture, I breathe in, experiencing joy, rapture, I breathe out, experiencing happiness, I breathe in, experiencing happiness, I breathe out. And these are feelings, they're in this, the section on feeling. And you know, as we pay attention to feeling, and being able to recognize that, you know, feeling it has many different nuances, and it's like like with joy or rapture, you know, we think, well, how does that arise? Where does that come from? And piti in the Pali, it's also, I mean, there's, it has this feeling of kind of exhilaration, joy, zest is sometimes translated as zest. So there's a certain energy behind it, and sometimes it can be a bit, not always positive or settling, in the sense of when there's that exhilaration, it's piti, it's kind of joyful, but it's excited. You know, it's like you're paying attention to the breath, breathing in, breathing out. Mind finally starts to settle, and you get it. Mind becomes a bit clearer, and sort of bang, you're off to the races. Just mind is. Yes, all of that. Wow, this is great, blah, blah, blah. And it feels great, but in terms of our long-term cultivation, we also need to be attentive to the drawbacks of even feelings that seem really positive, seem really, I mean, gratifying. And that's where the one of the qualities of perspectives that the Buddha encourages us to reflect on is an aspect of gratification. The gratification, the drawback, and the way out. And sort of looking at things, because whether that's on the positive end of the spectrum, that gratification, the positive aspect of it, it gets really highlighted, and it's important to see that. But within that, there's almost always going to be some kind of, okay, there's, what's the drawback? What's the problematic nature? And what's the way out? What's a way to real, true peace and freedom? So that holding that perspective as an investigation, it's one of the ways that the Buddha describes his own awakening, his own enlightenment, that it wasn't until I saw the gratification as the gratification, the drawback as the drawback, the way out as the way out, that I could declare my full and complete enlightenment. So it's a helpful perspective to be bringing up. So that recognition, obviously, that say it, bhiti is a motivating, inspiring factor, but you know, it can have that edge of unsettling or you know, it's sort of like a sugar rush. You know, it really tastes good right at that first rush of it, that first hit of it. But then it kind of frazzles after a while. It doesn't feel so good. That's why sukha is so important to pay attention, because it's more of a like a whole body mind experience of well being, being settled. That sukha, happiness, kind of a deeply satisfying, pleasurable feeling. That tempering that rush of the of bhiti. So that as we turn attention to refining our experience and learning how to find the things that really nourish over a long term, and seeing the say the benefits and this is something that, you know, there's a lot made of the Four Noble Truths. I mean, Ajahn Chah, it was always coming back to Four Noble Truths as the basis of investigation or practice. I tend to do it, many teachers. I mean, you look at the Buddha's own teachings, and you know, he keeps coming back, Four Noble Truths. I teach suffering and cessation of suffering. And as a perspective, and as a view, a way of holding things, it's really important. But it's also, at the same time, important to recognize that as a path of practice that the Buddha lays out for us, that all the different factors of the path, all the different factors of practice are things that elicit happiness and well-being. Mm-hmm. Keeping the precepts, having a foundation in virtue and integrity. And it's deeply satisfying and brings a real happiness to the mind. These different elements of mindfulness, clear comprehension, refining and settling the mind, a tranquility that starts to permeate our whole being. It's incredibly pleasurable. And there's aspects of investigation of truth and understanding of the true nature of things. It's extremely pleasurable to see things clearly. And so that's an aspect of practice in terms of those are parts of the path of practice. And in terms of view and how we keep refining and allowing ourselves to experience more more well-being is when we really understand the kind of the dukkha that is hidden, hidden by our delusions, hidden by our expectations, hidden by our kind of self-identifications. And the more we're willing to keep peeling away, or willing to allow that dukkha to manifest clearly, then we can understand and relinquish, release it. So that these two work together. So that cultivation of, let's say, experiencing joy, I breathe in, I breathe out. Experiencing happiness, I breathe in, I breathe out. This is an integral part. It's not the goal. It's an integral part. It's an aspect of the effect of the practice. But then we also take those feeling, and we have to keep investigating. How's it work? Which is the next aspect in the Anapanasati Sutta is, say, experiencing citta sankhara, experiencing the mental formations. I breathe in, experiencing mental formations, I breathe out. And mental citta sankhara is, of course, citta is mind, heart, all of the aspects of our, say, internal world. And sankhara is both a mental formation, but it's also that which does the forming. I think it's Ajahn Buddhadasa who translates it as mind conditioners, which condition the mind. So it's not, say, just a thing that has happened, but is a process. The mind being conditioned, being formed, being constructed, which is another translation of the word sankhara, is like a construct. So the mind construct, the mind constructor, so that what is being constructed. And in the suttas, when it's a mind formation or mind conditioner is described or defined, it goes perception and feeling, so that the underlying things that construct the mind in terms of all of its thoughts, ideas, emotions, qualities, manifestations, they arise out of perception and feeling. Those are the building blocks of what we experience as mind. So that, and perception is the, say, in the Pali, sanya. And sanya is its root meaning is in memory. So that that's a function of mind. Perception in terms of memory, association. And also, but through memory and association, we ascribe value to things that we experience. And this is happening, this is pre-verbal, it's when we experience the sense contact, then we ascribe a certain value to an experience through through memory, through association. It's not really thought through very much. It's just these things flash into the mind. If we had to think about absolutely everything to figure it out, our mind would just be paralyzed with inability to make our way through life. It's sort of like you don't really think about that's a door. I go to that door. Immediately there's a perception, and there's okay. I'll go in that direction, rather than sort of sitting here and I'll get up. The bell rings. Okay, now what do I do? we carry those perceptions with us, and then feeling is say vedana, and pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neither painful or pleasant, so a neutral feeling. And so it's quite fundamental. It's not going to the realm of emotion. But it's through that, those associations and feeling, that we start constructing our experience. We start to layer it with meaning. We start to react to it either out of our liking or our disliking, our wanting or our not wanting. Or we start to be confused by it. So those are reactions down the road. But then, that's why it's so important to understand the underlying construct. This is a mental for this experiencing the mental formation, in a sense, being willing to come back to what's that initial impulse? What is the movement of mind being generated by? And usually we're not quiet enough and clear enough to recognize him, or two, we're just so habituated that we just follow it. Or we're kind of happy to just keep reacting. I don't see the danger in that. But the Buddha is saying, no, this is really important. We need to experience these conditioners of the mind in order to make skillful choices. And we're creating, say, our trajectories in our life are determined by the choices we make. So that's like that very first verse of the Dhammapada is so important, is because it follows us, whether it's say the dukkha following us like the tracks from the wheel of the ox cart going along behind, or it's following us like our shadow, and it's just this happy, pleasant experience of well-being, but it's conditioned by the choices we make. So that understanding these aspects of perception and feeling. And the thing is that's why it's so important to say, sitting quietly, reflecting on it, tracking it back and seeing, what built that assumption? What built that reaction? And to be willing to keep coming back and investigating it. Because as soon as we experience something, we assume it's reality because we thought it. But why not? It's obviously true and real. It reminds me of a story from there was a some years ago. There's a Zen center up in Oregon, and at that time they were in a older place and quite new and makeshift, and so that their Zendo was in a kind of a large shed, and I was just a tin roof. So there's it was a period of time that it was unseasonably hot, so heat, which generally in Oregon, especially more toward the coast areas, say around that Portland area, that's not so common. So, but anyway, that was very hot and uncomfortable in the Zendo. So, one of the leaders of the community sort of thought, okay, well, what can we do to set up some hoses and some sprinklers up on the roof, and got the sprinklers going and then on top of the roof, so that they cooled the roof down. And then part of Sesshin, these Zen retreats, is that they have interviews, and they're very short, they're very stylized, and usually come in to express some experience or feeling or perspective to the teacher, and the teacher will either comment or encourage or discourage or whatever. And usually very briefly, very, 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 sort of bang, 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 sort of these people come in and go out. But then most often it's just that people express something, and then the teacher will just sort of ring the bell and then dismiss them, go back, continue their meditation. But anyway, so there's retreats going on, it's hot, they've got the set up the sprinkler system. The teachers receiving people, they come in, people line up outside, they come in and into the interview room, and one person, and I'm so grateful for them putting up that sprinkler system. It's cooling the roof down, it's really, really helping the meditation and the practice. Yeah, thank you. So then they go out, and next person comes in. And so, and you always usually do these formally, bow, and the bow, come in. So I'm totally at my wit's end. I can't believe it was a tough retreat already, and it's hot, and now you've got this stupid water dripping down the whole time. It's just driving me nuts. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make the whole retreat. You've just really made it difficult for us. And sort of, okay, the person goes out. Next person comes in. And it's so wonderful having the sound of water during a retreat. And it's just this, it just really helps me contemplate the kind of the forces of primordial nature, that interplay of the elements, and next person comes in, and I thought this was a Zen Buddhist retreat. I thought, we're here in this preserved area, and just people just wasting water. It's just so irresponsible, and I can't believe that this is a Buddhist retreat. Next person comes in. You know, I've been thinking about this system. It really needs improvement. It wouldn't be that difficult. Maybe a timer and a few valve switches is all it would take to make it really work more. Better. it's perception and feeling. How we get picked up and carried by them, and so that to be able to really pick it up as a meditation investigation, because it all seems so real, all seems so solid, and it spins the mind. That's what that mind conditioner is. It moves the mind. What is it that's moving the mind? What's pushing the mind? So that to be able to come, okay, perception and feeling, because the movement feels really strong. And of course the identification is pretty immediate, but that's where investigation is so important. Okay, where that deconstruction of experience, so we can start to see what's building it, what's creating it, is that perception and feeling, and as we continue, and then that's where. Of course, the next section, calming the mental formations I breathe in. Calming the mental formations I breathe out. And that's where mindfulness of breathing is so helpful, because you can calm the mental formations just by, one, an act of will. So, okay, I'm no longer going to let my mind have trains of thought like this. It's just sort of, there's no point in going there. But paying attention to that rhythm of the breath, paying attention to those feelings of well-being. And that's why those experiencing joy, I breathe in, experiencing happiness, I breathe in, breathe out. Those feelings of well-being are important to be familiar with, to be able to elicit. And then the actual staying with the breath, staying with the body. I think that's why the Buddha's practice of mindfulness of breathing is really kind of very, very complete, in that it's not just sort of a mental construct trying to make things. It's sort of, you see, that calming the mental formations I breathe in, calming the mental formations I breathe. It's the breathing that is that's the body, that is the backdrop, is the anchor. And bringing that attention and mindfulness to the experience, then we get an opportunity to see the mind more clearly. And sometimes when we're immersed in something, like a mood or a feeling or a thought, it's hard to get a perspective. It's hard to see it clearly. But that being with the breath is a way that we can have an anchor that allows us to gain a more clear perspective on what is it that keeps pushing us, what keeps keeps constructing and building. That's the we're busy builders, looking for something to make, to create, to be, to become, being able to let that settle. So I'll offer that for some consideration this morning.